Emma, when we arrived, you told me you had to put your big girl pants on. Why is that?
You're criticising the size of my bum.
No, scared. What were you scared about? Ring the doorbell.
After you. After you. You. Age okay. Before beauty. Beauty be before age.
Let's be honest. Why are we nervous? Come on.
Because I don't know whether that's a bell or some kind of cyber light.
Welcome to another instalment of the Clem & M podcast with me, Clemmie Stewart.
And me, Emma Kell.
Think of this as two passionate teachers talking over a brew and unpicking issues in education in the broadest sense of the term. What happens in school, what could happen in school, and what should happen in school.
We're speaking to influential people about how they feel about their own schooling and what they would do to change UK schools for the better. So how's your week been, Clem?
It's been a busy one. It's been a busy one, but enjoyable. I was watching your Twitter account with avid interest this week. I saw the tweet you sent out about toxic schools. And I've got to be honest, I was absolutely overwhelmed by some of the responses. So you obviously saw the DMs and the emails. I'm hoping none came from my stuff. But what kind of things were coming up there?
Well, I mean, I must admit, I'm completely overwhelmed by it. And you can always hear it in my voice. It's like when I wrote in my book about all the grim experiences teachers have. It really does bring me down because I've got about 300 messages in the forms of either tweets or DMs from people who've really, really, really been struggling in schools and quite vulnerable people in lots of ways. And this whole idea that I've been writing about this teacher crisis, we've been talking about this teacher crisis for years, and it's actually got worse rather than better.
What's that attributed to, do you think, in terms of what you're hearing from the ground?
I mean, I just feel that despite best efforts from some school leaders and even from Ofsted themselves, the performativity agenda, the intense scrutiny is still very much in force, and teachers are scared. Teachers are reptilian. Teachers are fight or flight. Not all teachers, not all schools. Of course not. But when you've got 300 messages in the space of 72 hours, you have to admit that there's some kind of problem. And yet, at the same time, I'm quite a positive person, yeah. I think, normally. And I don't want to be this harbinger of doom for the profession. And I'm acutely aware of how the whole thing can turn into leadership bashing. I know that you and I, I've tried, you know, you and I have touched on the subject, but as a head teacher, you know, you joked, but it must be quite uncomfortable, actually.
It's hard because as a head, you have ultimate responsibility for every member of your community, whether that's your children, your staff, and you want everybody to live happy, fulfilled, successful lives under your wing. And I think the biggest thing I've learned in recent times about staff well-being is it's not about yoga days. It's not about gym memberships. It's not about a packet of biscuits in the staff room. It's about equipping the adults you work with to lead on their own well-being and supporting their own development through school, but still being empathetic, compassionate, loving, forgiving, and showing that you're not perfect either. You know, none of us are perfect and we're all doing our best. I must admit, I was celebrating from my sofa when you sent out sort of the other end of the tweet of, come on, give me some uplifting stories too. Because I think it's really important that we write our own narrative as schools as well. We have to bring the positive back too, whilst remaining realistic about the challenges that are out there.
And I don't envy you as a head teacher sometimes because you're always so upbeat and so positive. But I was sitting next to a head teacher the other day at a training session, and she was talking about improving staff wellbeing in her school. And she tried to do something really lovely. She tried to give everyone a Christmas shopping day, not on the same day, but on days of their choice. And someone who she said, he's just never liked me, came into our office, knocked on the door and said, you're just doing this to tick a box. That's and so sometimes hard. As a head teacher, it can be so hard to win. Yeah. But you're right. It's not the bolt-on stuff.
It's not. And I think ultimately we're there to serve our children. And that's something we come back to all the time in my school. You know, we put the children at the heart of every moral compass and every decision we make. Staff are really important too, but ultimately they're for our children. And I'm sending a message out to this woman, be strong, stick up for what you believe in and don't listen to the naysayers. Says because you'd always have one.
And actually, staff well-being is about, well, the posh word, self-efficacy, isn't it? But it's about feeling you're doing a good job. So staff well-being does actually fundamentally come from those interactions with the children.
Of course it does. I must admit, I hate people that encourage teachers to do this, but I did pop into work this morning, Saturday morning, purely to tidy up my absolute monstrosity of a desk. And on there, I found a little note from a year three girl just telling me what a great job she thought I was doing. And I cannot tell you the impact of a little gesture like that, particularly on a Saturday. But that, you know, those moments where you realise actually what you're doing is having a direct impact on your children is more than you will ever need to drive up wellbeing, I think.
So when we planned this podcast, one of the people we really wanted to speak to was Fiona Miller. She's had a huge influence on me for a long time as a parent and also with her views on education. She is a campaigner. She's a journalist. She's passionate about education and parenting. She's a former advisor to Cherie Blair and she's an author as well. So she's a bit busy.
And she does like a good tweet too, getting stuck into education and politics under @SchoolTruth. And we're delighted she's joining us now. Thank you so much
for having
us.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm honoured.
Just so much to unpick and discuss with you around education and your thinking that will have developed over years and years of reflecting on practice and policy and everything that you're seeing. So we always start our podcast talking about your own experience as a child in education. So if you could think back to your time at school, what were those key things you learned and took away from?
Okay, well, I'm quite old compared to a lot of people who talk about these things now. So when I went to primary school, it was before progressive education even started. In fact, it happened when I was at primary school, because I remember that I was in a class that sat, everybody sat in rows. We did times tables. You know, it was very formal. And my brother, who was 2 years younger than me, got into everything had gone child-centered. The rows had gone. Everybody was making things with egg boxes, as my mother keeps telling me. It was egg box education, as she said. And I was one of the sort of the tail end of the 11 plus generation as well.
And what impact did that 11 plus sort of outcome have on you?
Well, I mean, it's very hard to just, I mean, people who live in those areas now will know, but I mean, the truth is that we were all separated out at 11 to different institutions. And like, it was horrible. I mean, you really knew that some people were going to the better schools, some people were going to the, you know, the sink schools, and the, that's what the secondary moderns were then. There were very few comprehensive schools, even in London. And that left me with a very, very profound sense that there was something wrong with that system, because obviously I went to a grammar school. Actually started there when I was 10, because I was put up a year at primary school. So, you know, I was quite young for my age, but it was wasn't a normal grammar school, to be perfectly honest. Camden School for Girls was, you know, very well known today. It was a very progressive girls only school. We voted to get rid of our school uniform when I was in the second year there. You know, it was definitely a very formative experience, but there's no doubt that the way London schools were organised in London then was bad. It was very, very bad. And the kids who got to the grammar schools got opportunities that the others didn't get.
And did you, from that, get a sense of realising you were perhaps more able than your friends? Or how did you understand that as a 10-year-old?
Well, the truth is that we didn't really stay in touch after we left primary school very much. Later on, when I became a teenager, I became friendly with children from other students from other schools who were not in the grammar schools. And that was when I really started to see the difference. I mean, you have to remember that in the early, you know, even into the 50s and 60s, at some secondary modern schools, you couldn't do O-levels. I did O-levels. It was O-levels and the CSE. And some schools would only offer certain qualifications to their students. So if you wanted to get the higher level qualifications, you were much more likely to do so in a grammar school. That was bad.
See, but that system still exists in Buckinghamshire. So I grew up in that system. Yeah.
But everybody does GCSEs.
Everybody does GCSEs, but so I did the 12 plus, and they still do it. And and the children talk in terms of passing and failing. Mm. You know, it's like when you put children into sets and give them animal names and imagine that they don't know which set's higher than the other one. You know, this is children still talk in terms of pass and fail with the grammar school system.
The risk of being contentious, I know when I taught in a state junior school in 2014, there was a sense from the senior school colleagues that took our children that if they were anything less than a level four, when we were still dealing in levels, then they would go straight into a special set at senior school.
I haven't got rose tinted spectacles on about the rest of the state sector. It's certainly true that there is a hierarchy and that exists, but the trouble is the hierarchy starts with the independent sector, then it moves to the grammar schools, then it moves to the selective faith schools, and then you get the, you know, all the new types of schools that have been created. And at the bottom you get the schools that are genuinely inclusive and taking everybody. And I think that's bad, and I've always thought that was bad, and that's really stemmed from my own school days of seeing how the selective system divided young people at 11. And I mean, what's interesting for me is that my children have gone to school in the same local authority, Camden, that I went to school, and they were able to have a very different experience going to secondary school, moving with all their friends to the same secondary schools. And I don't think they've had a worse education than mine. It's certainly very different to mine, but that's mainly because the sort of apparatus that's been put around education has changed. I mean, there wasn't the same pressure, there wasn't the same parental involvement, there wasn't Ofsted, there weren't league tables, there weren't, you know, schools weren't under the same pressure, and it was just a very different vibe. To and I think in some ways our education was better because there was more room to explore and less pressure, But in other ways, I say they have a much more rigorous education than I had.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't work very hard at school and I didn't do particularly well. I had a great time and I would say it was a character-forming experience, but I don't think I would have been allowed to leave with the pretty mediocre A-level grades today that I was allowed to leave with then. And that was one of the best grammar schools in the country.
Right, so you were highly able, you were moved up a year, and yet you describe yourself as not a particularly...
Yeah, I was a very social animal, you know, I got into London, this part of London in the 70s, I mean, you can imagine what it was like, you know, it was like, it was there was a lot going on and I got swept up in that. But then I did go back to education later on, I went to university, I got into UCL later on and learned to enjoy work. And so when I talk to young people now, I always say to them, you know, it's all about second chances as well.
Do you have any regrets from your time at school?
Do I regret not working? No, not really, because I had fantastic friends. And I think friendship is one of the things that's vastly underestimated about education. You know, making friends, making good friendships, keeping them for life, learning how to make relationships with people. And I think that is part of education. Sorry to sound like a sort of soft libtard, but I mean, I do think that's important. So I made great friends. I had, I learned a lot and I got enough qualifications then to get me onto university later on. So I do think that's important to get the GCSEs and the A-levels under your belt.
Do you think your children's relationships are different having been to a more comprehensive schooling system than perhaps you might have gone to?
With each other or?
Well, they're very with the different. People that they were with the people they spent their time with.
Absolutely. I mean, they've grown up with a far more diverse collection of people than we did. I mean, given that they live in a very, a professional upper middle class household, they've had, you know, friends, they've got friends now who are electricians and plumbers and, you know, barristers and in prison. I mean, they've all got slight Cockney accents, which some, I remember people saying to me, aren't you worried your children will have a Cockney accent? Right. So you're sending them to state school, they'll have a Cockney accent. But I mean, I quite like that because people can't really place them.
It's amazing how people worry for you. We get that. Aren't you worried your daughter looks like a boy?
Yeah.
Not really. I started
the things I've heard, you know, when my kids were at primary school, the three favourites were, I have to take my children out of the school, from the reception class because she hasn't got any intellectual equals. That was the first one. The second one, I can't send her to that school because the manners of the children there won't be the same as, you know, the manners of the school, the children at the school I'm going to send her to. And I always think of that when I watch Boris Johnson and all these fantastically well-educated people in public life. You know, actually the manners of the people, some of the people my children were educated in were far better and their sense of values. And then they won't be able to read, they're going to a state school, and finally they'll have a Cockney accent. Well, they're worse things in life.
And whose fears were those?
Other people's fears for me.
As in sort of friends or people you knew?
People I knew.
Gosh. Yeah. And how did they, I imagine you were quite robust in your response to those. How did they take that?
The truth is that if you come from a two graduate professional home, with two graduate parents, professional home, and you go to a good enough school, you're going to be fine. Mm. And of course, when my son went to Oxford, I remember one of these people saying to me, was it a special scheme to get people from state schools into Oxbridge? Because they couldn't really bring themselves to accept after all these things they'd said that he could have got there on merit.
That's extraordinary.
But you know, your chances are in a good London comprehensive school from a professional background with sort of graduate parents from good universities, that your chances are you will do just as well as your peers in the local private school. But those aren't the kids we're talking about, are we? We're talking about the kids who don't come from homes like ours and what happens to them.
It's amazing how many people from background, I suppose, two professionals in a family, people do choose to send their children to independent schools. Mm. So I live in quite a leafy part of Hertfordshire. Schools are lovely, and yet people are still sending their children private.
And everybody's so anxious now, you see, and that's one of the worst things that's come out of the sort of marketisation of education, I think, is it's created this sort of parental angst that just didn't really exist in my
Opinion. And it's a very genuine angst. Mm. So when you actually, I'm far less combative than I was in my 20s, so when you actually sit down and listen to people and their reasons, their reasons are that, A, they can afford it, B, they say they couldn't sleep at night knowing they haven't given their children the very best possible opportunities. Mm. And then once you've given that opportunity to one child and you've got two more coming through, the next thing you know, you've spent the best part of £500,000 pounds on it. Mm. But it is a very genuine, in the case of these parents, almost moral imperative to do the best, do better for their children than they had for themselves.
Yeah. I think now that parents feel very judged by their children in the way that they didn't when I was growing up. So parents feel that their children's achievements will reflect on them, and people are worried that you know, they won't do very well, and that will reflect on them as parents. So, I mean, once you've opted out of that thing, which we did as parents, we didn't even look at any other schools. We just went to the ones that are geographically closest to where we live. Life becomes a lot easier. And I see a lot of my friends who have got kids in private schools or have had, and the different pressures that they're under, the competition still carries on within that system. Mm. And it's actually kind of even more toxic in a way, because they've made that choice to prove that they're the best. Mm. So if they don't prove that they're the best, it means that they're judged even more harshly by their peers. Or that's how they feel, I think. So it's the level of private tuition that goes on, even in the independent sector.
There definitely is. And again, I think this goes back to that conversation around generalisation and the types of independent schools. And certainly, you know, the Twitter campaign hashtag abolish Eton, I think, has cast a very strong light on a lot of this. And for somebody who's worked in both private schools and state sector schools, there are very, very different types of schools within that. And some of the parents that send children to independent schools are doing it for very, very specific reasons beyond that social cachet and the license it gets. But they are competitive environments. And I think it's an incredibly difficult decision for parents to make. And certainly when I look at my own upbringing, I have three brothers and myself. Some of us went to private, some of us went to state. And in fact, my youngest brother moved into the state system around 14, 15. And had he gone in sooner, he would have done far better. Mm. And I think parents do need to be brave and make those decisions based on what's right for their child. Even within a family, every child would need something different.
Mm. I've always imagined I'd really hate working in the independent sector, simply because, not just because of my political views, but simply because the parents must be really quite difficult at times. Obviously, you can't comment on individual cases.
As a governor, I've dealt with some pretty difficult parents in the state sector.
I think parents have, and I say this as somebody who is not a parent, I think parents have the hardest job in the world, wherever they are, whatever they are doing. And I have the utmost respect for all parents, because ultimately all they want is the best for their child. And how that comes across sometimes can come out in the most beautiful ways that radiate sunshine, or it can come out in different ways. And I think a job of any leader, whether you're a leader of a state school or an independent school, is to manage that, harness it, and turn it into a really effective relationship. But yeah, you do need to be robust from time to time.
Diplomatic answer.
Are you willing to tell us about any of your difficult parents in the state sector?
Yeah, I think there are. And I do think the whole thing about parent choice, remember we're sort of 30 years on from that now, aren't we? It did introduce something new into the state system. That remember, I was educated before parent choice, before Ofsted, before any of these things. So I think that was the biggest difference, actually, in my education, my children's education. I think parent choice did invest something in parent. This phrase, the best for your child, you just didn't hear that. And people wanted to do the best for your child, but articulating it as, I must do the best for my child. I mean, that's why I wrote my book, The Best for My Child, you know, that, because I think that's been a driving force for a lot of people. It's not always been healthy. And it hasn't always been healthy for schools either.
Mm. And I suppose this goes back to how, as a parent, you can find out what the best is. Again, I've got friends who are now of that age where they're starting to have children. And the amount of times I've been sent random Ofsted reports to read and unpick whether that'll be the best school for their child. It's a 4-page document written by somebody who spent a day there and looked at some data. And I try and encourage every single one of them to go and look round.
Talk to the head. It's so important.
Absolutely.
Look at the kids, talk to the children.
Absolutely. And we always say it's a bit like buying a house. You'll get sent the particulars of four or five houses, and you'll then walk into one and you'll just feel in your heart, this is where my values will be celebrated, this is where my ethos will chime with yours. And that, I think, is how you find the best, whatever it looks like.
And go and look at the toilets. That was always really good advice. Oh, seriously, as a parent and as a teacher.
Oh, my pupils will tell any visitor what the toilets are like.
Yeah.
And the cleaning cupboard, actually. They always show visiting parents the cleaning cupboard.
So I really wish, in terms of accountability now, that we could broaden it out into something more than exam results, that tried to wrap up some of these other things that parents actually do care about.
How could you capture that?
Well, I don't know. There was this report card idea that came and went, wasn't there? And then there was another idea of having a sort of, you know, an online portal where parents could go, and schools would have, you know, it wouldn't just be exam results. It would be things like behaviour. It would be things like extracurricular activity. It would be how the kids felt about the school, how the staff felt. You know, I mean, in an era of sort of TripAdvisor and everything, it's not unrealistic to ask parents to say how they feel about their school and how young people feel about their school. You get a pretty quick answer. You'd work it out pretty quickly, I think, if you had a more rounded set of indicators. everything's reduced now. This, you know, you go on the DfE website, look at school, it's just reduced to four bullet sort of
dashboard,
and it doesn't really tell you anything like the full story of what that school's about.
No, it doesn't. I think your comment about school marketing is such an interesting one, and I noticed walking down here actually a really fantastic sign about the quality of Camden schools, just in the bus stop, you know, why our schools are so fantastic. And I think it was a third point that was talking about the focus placed on science and the creative arts, and I think parents are looking for more than just some really strong SATs results, and I think schools have to work hard to capture that if they're to keep healthy numbers on roll, and just evidence that value added. Why should you invest your time in this school and send your child here for those years that they will never get back? I think that's a huge responsibility, particularly for early years and primary.
Schools are getting more platforms though, aren't they? But the problem is it tends to be quite extreme, so people will discuss a school rule that they don't agree with on Facebook. And then it becomes mum's trial net. By Facebook for the school. Or mum's net, yeah.
But that's going to happen anyway, you know. So in a way, I think it'd be better to contain it in some sort of format that gave you, even if it just, you could have a link from the DfE website to something else that told you more about the school. You know, how many trips do they do? There's all sorts of things. How many trips do they do? Do they do extracurricular performances? Do they have good sport? Do they, you know, just get a bit more of a flavour?
Because, well, it's the same with teachers. So I get teachers asking me all the time, you know, how do I find a school that's right for me? And one of the answers is always, well, find another context if you're miserable. But how you do that...
And again, visiting.
Exactly.
You have to visit. Just thinking about how schools are perceived in a bigger audience, where do you stand on programmes like Educating Yorkshire or the Educating series? How
I mean,
do you feel
to be perfectly honest, I haven't watched any of them. I'll tell you why, because I was spending all my time writing about education and then as a school governor as well. So a lot of my evenings are spent talking about education. When I come home at the weekend, I want to watch something, I want to have something completely different.
And then we made you come here on a weekend to talk about education.
I do feel that, and I know Vic Goddard very well, you know, who's from Passmore's, he did Educated Essex, which was his first one. And he's a great interviewer. I don't know if you're going to talk to him.
We know him well as well. Yeah, we're so going to get him. We're coming for you, Vic. We're coming.
But I think the thing about that programme, and I think it's a law of diminishing returns with all these things, the more they're on, the less people register them. But so many people said to me, because they showed the school warts and all, didn't they?
They did.
A real comprehensive
they really
school
did.
That, you know, they felt completely, people who hadn't experienced comprehensive education today, it really changed their view of comprehensive education because they could see how complicated it is running a very inclusive school, but also how warm it was and how there was something very good at the heart of it. So from that point of view, I thought it was a really positive thing that it opened the doors. And because there's a lot of myths about comprehensive education, especially amongst the generation that went through the grammar school system, like my generation, you know, that they're... You know, people think comprehensives are like the secondary moderns. But if you've got a grammar school in your area, you can't have a comprehensive school. You can only have a secondary modern. So I went to Northern Ireland and made a programme there about the selection test in Northern Ireland. And it was so frustrating talking to the young people. They kept talking about these comprehensive schools and how awful they were down the road for them. I said, well, they can't be comprehensive schools because you've got the top 30%. They're not really fully inclusive schools. They're not all ability schools. But they didn't understand that because the only thing they could see was the secondary modern and the grammar school.
So where does that misconception come from then, and how do we address it?
The comprehensive movement only really came into force in the 1970s, didn't they? So you've still got a lot of people in positions of power and authority in the media and so on who went through the grammar school system. I actually think we're about to see the comprehensive generations kind of break through. And one of the things I mean to do is start making a list. I read somebody had made a list the other day of all these people who've been to private schools, you know, James Blunt and these athletes and these rowers and so on. And as if to say only people who are the only successful people in society go to private schools. I mean to start keeping a list of all the people who've really been successful who went to state schools.
Yeah.
A sort of alternative list, because if I look at my kids' generation just going into their 30s now, I mean, they're doing fantastic things. You know, one of them is an architect, the other one's an engineer, the other one's a psychiatrist, you know.
We interviewed one a couple of weeks ago who came to school here as a refugee from Afghanistan and is now making documentaries.
You know, I think there's a myth that, you know, that and I think the successive governments of even the Labour government to a certain extent contributed to it by creating the sort of specialist schools idea, that the bog standard comprehensive, you know.
Oh, that was a good phrase, wasn't it?
It wasn't actually Alistair's phrase, somebody else's phrase, but he did use it in his briefing. But I mean, that they were churning out very uniform type of sort of slightly dumbed down young people, when in fact that's never been the case, because even within the comprehensive system, there's a huge variety. I mean, there's girls' schools, boys' schools, faith schools, you know, co-educational schools, schools with uniforms, schools without uniforms.
Well, what do you think about that fragmentation of schools?
I think diversity is generally a good thing. Yeah. I think you have a diversity in a fair admission system, so parents can choose within reason a different sort of school. That seems to be perfectly reasonable, yeah. Mm. What I don't like is the selection, so it's the school that's choosing the pupils rather than the other way around.
I would say the schools within my academy trust are held to greater account than the school that I was at under local authority. Mm. It's difficult to compare because there's 4 years between, but the school I was at under local authority was in special measures and came got good and good without standing towards the end. But we were under more scrutiny under academy than we were.
I think that's probably true, but then you look at these schools like that school in Wakefield where they took £1 million out of the trust and then shut it down and just handed it back to the state. I mean, that should not be allowed to happen. The orphan schools that nobody wants. Off-rolling, the off-rolling is a lot to do with the academisation because the local authority really should have strong local oversight on things like that, the movement of pupils between schools and exclusion, and I think that's really critical, and that's falling apart in some areas, and that's what's allowing some schools to just offer all the pupils they don't want.
So if you could design your perfect approach in one of these manifestos coming up around education, what would your key target
Well, I mean, obviously I would say have a comprehensive system, end all selection. I'd go for reform of admissions. I think because I'm more secondary focused now as a governor of a secondary school, I really think the 14 to 19 area needs to be looked at. I think the GCSE is defunct, really. We don't need an exam at 16. But a lot of successful countries have a final diploma at 18, and we should be moving to something like that.
I know what you mean, and I was reading your article on the way here about that. Just thinking about it purely from an on-the-ground point of view, I think if we said to teachers now, we're going to abolish the GCSE and put something new in place, despite the fact that I think a lot of us felt quite strongly against the new GCSE, we've only just got used to it.
That's true, but I'm not suggesting... I mean, I think everybody tries to do... In education reform, people try to do things too quickly.
Right.
You know, Gove brought those exams in far too quickly without trialling.
Oh, it was horrendous. I remember standing in the classroom saying to the students, that's just the way it is.
Yeah.
And we were all so stressed out.
Yeah.
And it was just eventually realising that, you know, we were just going to have to get on with it.
Yeah.
But
you could say, like, you know, we're going to move to a situation in 10 years' time where we gradually phase out exams at 16.
Mm.
There'll be something at 16, you know, because some people might want to go off to college or do something different or do an apprenticeship, but that everything would move to a broad... I mean, these baccalaureate-type qualifications seem to be much better because you don't specialise so early
as well.
Our system specialises so early.
Mm.
So you can do a broad spectrum of subjects, and then you could wrap up the vocational qualifications and the academic qualifications in one final diploma. So nobody would leave having failed. I mean, at the moment we fail a third of our pupils at 16, they effectively fail.
Mm.
That seems to me that is a failing system, not a successful system.
Oh,
we should have a system where everybody can get to 18 and leave with something that takes them on to something else.
And on the ground, it is brutal standing in that room of students with special educational needs who get extra time on top of the 1 hour 45 minutes to go through the text that for whatever reason is so challenging to them, it could drive them over the edge.
It's very harsh, that. You don't need to do that. I mean, you really don't need to do that. That's not to say that the final diploma wouldn't be at different levels and encompass different things, but the idea that everybody leaves with a qualification that takes them onto something else seems to me a very positive, progressive idea.
Mm. And that's something else you talk of, obviously, with Blair's focus on education and getting more and more people to go to university. Now we've lived that for a decade. Do you still think that was the right output? Do you think we should be looking at output slightly differently?
Probably, yes. It's very difficult, isn't it? Because when I left school, 10% of the population went to university. I mean, why did I get into university college with a B, a C and a D? A-level grades. You have to have 2 5A stars now probably to get in there. But the reason was because half the 90% of the population didn't go to university.
Yeah.
It was, you know, it was easier to get in and the whole process was different. But so I think having that as an option for kids who wouldn't otherwise go to university is incredibly important.
Mm.
You don't want to go back to, when people say too many people go to university, what they mean is, oh, I still want my kids to go to university, but everybody else is, don't go.
Mm.
You know, they don't mean, oh, my kids are going to become a plumber and those other kids can go to university. So you've got to have that option there. But it's the problem in the English system is this differential status between vocational and academic, which has always blighted the system. And it doesn't exist in the same way in other countries to quite an extent.
Mm.
So countries like Germany, which have good vocational education, it's a high status option.
Yes.
It isn't here. So you're not really going to change that thing about what's the alternative to university until the alternatives seem to have higher status than they do at the moment.
Although in Germany, they actually narrow students off even earlier, they don't.
Yeah, and that has a consequence because they've got a very long tail of underachievement amongst certain groups, immigrant people, just poorer children particularly. I mean, you can't actually draw comparisons between different countries very easily, but I do think that point about higher quality, higher status, vocational qualifications is important. This T level, it's sort of come and gone. I mean, nobody even knows what it is, do they?
No.
It's such a missed opportunity. It's such a missed opportunity.
Whereas really Mike Tomlinson's idea of the diploma that had academic, you know, I think if that had been allowed to happen, and to be fair, that was Tony Blair who shut it down, and that had a 10-year lead time, we'd just be starting now to get into a new, a reformed 14 to 19 phase, which I think would have been better.
So on the subject of politics and education, I feel increasingly uncomfortable about linking the two. And I say that having, I go on Twitter quite a lot. I love Twitter. And I've seen a lot of things recently around teachers becoming very closely linked to specific politics and specific politicians. And I just feel really uncomfortable. And I don't know if that's my own naivety around it or whether it's my own wish
linked
to...
Linked in what way, though?
Either arguing directly for one party over another while they're still practising in the classroom, or tweeting sort of 30-minute videos about how they are supporting a manifesto in a particularly strong way. And I just feel slightly uncomfortable about that, but I don't know if other people do.
My students are always really curious about my politics, and I'll tend to make light of it, and I'll joke about it, and I'll say, well, take a wild guess, and you know me, and you know about this, and you know about this, so I'll let you take a wild guess. I don't know.
And if you were approached by a specific party for whom you did tend to lean towards more, would you involve yourself with their materials, do you think?
Well, no, that's simply because I decided not to get into politics. Because
I mean, as a governor, obviously people know my politics because it's usually pretty well publicised the outside world. But I mean, I tend to try and steer clear of it as much as possible. I don't think it's helpful to bring that into that arena.
And as a governor, if it came to you that, I don't know, one of your teachers had been and was clearly linked to your school, had been very explicit on Twitter about their political leanings and quite contentious comments about various different things happening.
Well, around here, it would probably only be a problem if they were a Tory. I mean, I know what you mean. I think there might be parents who'd be upset by that.
I think I'm going to disagree with you, Clemmie. I think we've got bigger things to worry about. I mean, if they're tweeting about their drug-fueled night out on a Saturday,
I don't think they should be telling how to think politically. Definitely
Or sharing students' results on Twitter.
But if the students are on social media, so take Twitter, for instance, where you can follow anybody, so I'm thinking of a specific teacher now who talks an awful lot from their classroom sometimes about how they feel about private schools and how they feel about abolishing Ofsted and everything else. Those students could easily find that on Twitter and watch it and therefore have a very clear window into how their teacher would vote. Is that a problem? And that's not a loaded question. Is it a problem?
Are we slightly raising the pedestal that our students put us on, though? I mean, we tell them we believe all sorts of different things and they don't go off and treasure that view for the rest of their lives.
And this links brilliantly back to the conversation we had with Camilla back on podcast number one. And she had some quite strong opinions on this. So let's hear what they were.
I do worry sometimes, and you can counteract this, that we're not just teaching our children what to think, but how to think. And that really bothers me. I don't want kids saying, well, I actually think that capitalism isn't a bad idea, because like the alternatives like haven't really worked out very well. And I like Greta Thunberg, but I don't know if this is the right way to go about it, and be closed down by teachers going, you don't know what you're talking about. And indeed pupils. We must have these open, and you know, this no platforming at universities. And it's not just if you don't agree with me, then you're wrong. There's a narrative of if you don't agree with me, then you're wicked.
Initial reactions on that?
But no, I mean, I haven't come across many teachers, any I can think of in my 30 years as a parent and a governor, who tell children, dictate to children how they should feel politically about things. Alistair and I stopped being journalists in the mid-90s and went to work for Tony Blair, who was leader of the opposition. So my children's, much of their primary and most of their secondary education took place while we worked with the Blairs, either in opposition or in Downing Street.
This is Alistair Campbell, your husband.
That, you know, that could have been an opportunity for people to bring their political views to the table, especially at the time of the Iraq War and when other controversial things were going on. There was the Academies programme. There were controversial reforms to education. But actually, I remember them being, if anything, very protective and not confrontational, or not bringing their own views to the table. And I think that was one of the things that helped my children greatly in that, what was a difficult period often.
And did your children bring their views into your sort of, you know, sat around your beautiful table now, your sort of dinner party conversations or children having supper with you, did they share their political views with you?
I think they were very loyal to their dad at the time. You know, they didn't want to hear people dissing their dad. Mm-hmm. So, and we had people protesting literally outside the house in our pathway, you know, fake blood and pretending to die and things. It was horrible.
How old were your children then?
What was it, 2003, 14, 15, the older two? My daughter was at primary school, yeah.
And how did they cope with that? I mean, that must have been incredibly difficult.
I think they kind of took it in their stride, you know. I mean, they were very, I mean, they, yeah, they did take it in their stride. I mean, if you talk to them now about it, I'll tell you the one thing that they will say is that they could cope with all that. What they hated was when he and I used to argue about things.
Well, because you were opposed to the Iraq war, weren't you? That must have been.
And that was the worst thing for them. As long as we were getting on, they could cope with it. But as soon as we all fell out, we started falling out. And it was quite vicious at times.
So this must be sort of the Campbell Miller circle of trust. We have the same in the Stewart family, where we can say anything about each other to each other. But if anybody outside of that dares pick on any of us, there has to be a united front. And we've had that with Dad over, you know, 40 years of the role he does. There have been certain times where we have had to be very restrained in our response to how people talk about your dad. You do feel very protective of them. And I'm sure it's the same with you, with your husband. And again, I heard a brilliant podcast where he was being interviewed by Elizabeth Day.
Yeah.
It was a brilliant podcast. And he spoke so beautifully about you.
Well, that's nice. We're not married, by the way. One of my other campaigns is the campaign for equal civil partnerships for heterosexual couples, which has just come to fruition now. The only of one of my campaigns has actually been truly successful. So they become legal on the 31st of December.
Oh, congratulations.
I mean, we haven't planned ours yet, but I mean, it will mean that people who are in opposite sex relationships can have a civil partnership rather than get married.
Oh, brilliant.
And have that's the same protection under the law. So I think that's really good.
Excellent.
But, so we're not married, but yes, I think you're absolutely right. I think it is a weird dynamic, isn't it, in the family? But
it is. But I imagine your challenges were far greater.
I suppose what I'm trying to say is that the Downing Street job, which brought them many advantages, although it was amazing how quickly they got bored with them, because one of my jobs was to read the mail that the Prime Minister Cherie got, and there were always all these letters from children saying, oh, can we come to Chequers at the weekend, we'd love to visit Chequers, and we'd always have to say no. And we'd get these invitations, and I'd say to my kids, we're going to Chequers. Oh god, not Chequers again.
Another long car journey.
Not Chequers again.
I love
can't
that
we just stay in London.
Do you know, that reminds me of a time when Mo Molum phoned our house phone to talk to Dad and invite him to Stormont, and she phoned
Hillsborough. We went to one of those weekends,
and I picked up the phone and she said, oh, hi, can I speak to Alistair? And we've been trained very clearly to say no. So I said, no, I'm afraid that's not possible. She said, no, I really need to speak to him. And I said, well, who's speaking? And she said, Mo. And I said, Mo who? And she said, Mo Molum. And I called her a liar and I hung up. Which to this day I still get teased about quite regularly.
Well, I can tell
by
you,
my
missed
family.
An amazing weekend, because she used to have these, I suppose I can say it now, she used to have these incredible weekends at Hillsborough Castle.
Oh, I can imagine.
She'd assemble this vast crowd of people.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of drinking and carousing well into the night, being Mo. And I mean, all our kids went to that. So they had fantastic experiences. They did. But, you know, in the end, I think what really got to them was when it brought conflict into our family. Yeah, everything else was bearable.
Would you abolish Ofsted?
No, absolutely not. I think that's a terrible policy.
Would you change it?
Yeah, I mean, I did a fringe meeting at the Labour Party conference this year with Angela Rayner and a sort of and one of the things I was trying to explain to her and other people is that, you know, Ofsted sort of, I mean, it is independent, but it also belongs to the government of the day. So when you say you wish we could separate education and politics, I mean, education is very political because it goes to the heart of the sort of society we want. But if a government wanted Ofsted to do different things, to focus on inclusion, for example, or happiness, or they could do that. It's just a vehicle for doing things. As it happens at the moment, it's driving people towards certain forms of behaviour. So I think the idea is to keep an inspection service. And I mean, I don't know how I got into doing this in the first place, was because I became a parent governor at my children's primary school, which is one of the first schools to be failed by Ofsted. And it was a really sobering experience, but it was the right thing for the school. Mm-hmm. It was a terrible school and it was letting down an awful lot of children. And I worry that if you abolish the inspectorate altogether, we'll go back to the sort of early 80s, early 90s, when a lot of schools were allowed to carry on with really substandard education. And that was chronic and shouldn't and scandalous and shouldn't be allowed. So I think, yeah, let's keep an inspection service, but let's make it part of a more generous account of what makes a good education.
Were you one of these parents who was really involved in all of the crafting and the PTA and the tombolas, and how involved were you in your...
Well, I became a school-age parent of school-age children in 1992, just yeah. after the 92 election. And I was working full time and writing a book at the time, so I had very little free time. I felt really guilty about it. So I thought one of the ways I'll stand. The parent governor election came up, and I thought I'll stand because then I'll get more involved in the school. And even though I can't always be there at the gate, I'll know what's going on. I didn't really know what I was letting myself in for. And of course, I got elected.
So you had to be voted for by the other parents.
By the other parents.
Oh, and wow. In North London, it's competitive, isn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, we don't have that.
But then the school hit this absolutely terrible situation because that was 92. Then Ofsted came in 93. We were one of the first schools to be Ofsted. It was an absolute disaster. Gosh. Half the governing body left, half the parents left, took their kids out of the school. It was a very divisive situation locally. And there were a group of parents left who really fought. And they were either both on the PTA and the governing body, incidentally. We're all still friends. Who really, really were determined to make that school better. And it was you talk about parents feeling judged. I mean, there were moments when I'd come home and think, God, you know, because another thing people said to me was, you're treating your children like a political experiment. I mean, they shouldn't be in a failing school. You should take them out. And there were times when I thought, yeah, God, maybe I am, you know, is this the wrong thing? Are we using them as sort of political guinea pigs? But in fact, they were fine. And the right thing to do was to make that school better for those kids who didn't have the advantages that ours had. So I was very, very active, very active. And then when I left number 10, somebody wrote an article in The Guardian, a local parent here, about how he was taking his daughter out of a local state primary school to send her to a private school. So I phoned The Guardian and said, I'd like to have the right to reply.
I read this article.
So I wrote another piece saying why I'd pay not to send my children to private schools. And as a result of that, Channel 4 asked me to make the film about parent choice in 2003. And then I got the Guardian column. And that sort of changed my career trajectory completely because I was basically a general news or stroke political journalist before. Mm. And that's when I started specialising in education. So I would never have been doing this sitting here now if I hadn't become a school governor.
I am a governor and I absolutely love that job. And it's an academy school. It's one of our academies. And they had an Ofsted track record of 30 years of either being requires improvement or inadequate.
Really?
I don't quite know how that
was.
How
many schools are in this chain then?
We've got over 80, United Learning.
Oh God, yes, I know them. Yeah. That was John Coles, wasn't it?
Yeah, still is.
Yeah. He's very good.
Still
he's
is.
Still there?
He is, yeah.
He's really CEO. Good. Yeah.
And so I'm head of one of the independents, but I'm a governor of one of our academy schools. And so it was in special measures or requires improvement 30 years.
Yeah.
And then this fantastic head, who I won't name because he would kill me, came in and took over about 3 years ago. And we went through the Ofsted process back in December and I was there to represent the governing body and they were found to be outstanding in every area.
Brilliant.
Which was incredible. And I strongly believe that combination of academisation and Ofsted and the leadership of that head and the brilliant children in that school enabled it to go through that process. But it goes back to your comment as you do firmly believe that outcomes need to be better for those children. Mm. And that process enabled that to happen, I think.
Mm. So you don't, what do you think about abolishing Ofsted?
I think absolutely needs to remain.
Yeah.
I think it needs to not become something that teachers fear.
Yeah, that's terrible.
And I think, again, having gone through the process of being in a school that was in special measures that came out with good, we had the same inspector that came back every term. He knew our school, he knew our context, he even knew our pupils. He'd walk in, and I won't name the child, but would say, where is he today? And he would look under my desk because he knew that that's where that boy felt safe. And he was learning, he was accessing the curriculum, but he was under my desk. And he was the most phenomenal man. And going through that process with him was incredibly formative. I think it's the best CPD I've ever had. Whereas I think having a random inspector that pops up 2 years, reads some paperwork and visits your school for a day, I think it's an incredibly difficult job for them to fully understand that school and make judgments on it. But no, I'm a firm believer in keeping a form of inspectorate, certainly.
Yeah, well, that's so, but I'm very pleased for you. I mean, it's a wonderful thing when that happens. And that transformation was what we were able to do at our local primary school. And it's really one of the things I'm proudest of in my life because in fact, in terms of my political activity, because I'm no longer a party member, obviously, I consider my politics to be done through being a school governor, not overtly, but by making a difference to my community. And I think
so that inextricable link between education
people underestimate
and
how important figures school governors are in their local communities.
Yeah,
absolutely. Governors are so important.
I mean, I'm
going to
probably give it up quite soon because I've done it for long enough. But I mean, and my children always say, Mum, you haven't got any kids at school. Why are you still going to tied to the term time? You know, if I'm a chair of governors, you're tied. You can't go away in term time. You've always got meetings in the evening. But I mean, it has been very, very satisfying, more satisfying actually than direct political activity, other than obviously seeing the Labour government win in 1997 was incredible. But I mean, thereafter, I can't say there have been any, many moments as satisfying as making a difference to your local community.
Mm. And that relationship between the head teacher and the school governor is so powerful, isn't it?
It doesn't always work. I mean, I've seen it work. I've been involved with relationships that aren't very good. Mm. I mean, they've got to get on very well, the chair and the head.
Yes.
But in a way that's respectful and has some difference, some distance.
Has some challenge.
Yeah.
That person needs to hold you to account.
You can't be kind of friends with them. It's difficult to get it right. But I think if you do get it right and there is a respect and, you know, you like each other and you respect each other, I think it can work very well and you keep some distance.
Yeah, and that trust, that absolute trust that you can challenge each other because ultimately you're trying to achieve exactly the same thing. And that's so important.
You alluded in your recent article for The Guardian to teacher retention and teacher turnover. And I've done quite extensive work on this, gone from being quite optimistic about it to actually feeling quite flat from the number.
You'll probably know more than me about it.
The number of teachers. But yeah, I mean, are teachers justified in complaining about workload?
Absolutely. I mean, I really don't think there's any other profession where people are put under such a spotlight and expected to work. I mean, it's not just the workload, it's the level of stress that goes with it, isn't it? You know, where you're scrutinised so much and you could be held to account at any moment in a way that could jeopardise your career, the career of other people. And no, I think it's a really tough gig at the moment being a teacher. And I think we don't make it, it's suited successive politicians to throw the dirt at teachers in a way to justify their reforms. And I've seen it happen with all the parties who've been in power. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, we need to make teaching a high status, highly respected profession. Otherwise, you're not going to attract people back. And at the moment, it doesn't feel like it is high status and respected enough.
I think we're getting there with the Chartered College of Teaching. The Chartered College of Teaching is moving from strength to strength. And I think that will make a huge difference.
But what's really depressing for me, because I mean, Camden is a good place to work. Mm. People like working in Camden schools. But there is even a teacher shortage starting here now.
Gosh.
And that's partly because of property prices, people moving out and so on. But you're losing a certain group of people in the certain age range, I would say early 30s, late 20s, early 30s.
We had to leave this area because I got married and we wanted to buy a house together and we couldn't afford to stay in the area.
You're losing them to the profession as well, which is really regrettable, I think. And I think there's probably something about women as well and more flexible working and more imaginative, to go back to my book, more imaginative ways of allowing people to have good work-life balance and have a family in education.
Yeah.
I think your comment about status is absolutely right as well, because there are some great people coming to teaching as a second career. And I think the higher the status of teaching is, the more people we will attract into that. Mm. Would you ever be a teacher?
Not now, but I mean, once I really got into being a governor, I thought, you know, maybe I'd quite like to have been a head. I would have liked.
No, but straight in with heads. Forget which subject.
I'd have to become a teacher, but you know, I'd quite like to.
What kind of a teacher would you have been?
Probably a history teacher. Yeah, subject, you mean, yeah.
Well, but also how would you see
secondary. But I mean, I think by the time I realised it was far too late for me to start again. But I mean, my best teacher at school was my history teacher. I absolutely loved
him. There's something very cool about history teachers.
Yeah, I absolutely loved him. And I had this really strange experience with him later on in my life because he was married to a then celebrity when we were at school. He just divorced from her. She was a newsreader, actually, one of the first women newsreaders. Probably your dad knows her, called Pamela Armstrong.
I'll have to ask.
He would remember her. She was one of the first female news. Anyway, my history teacher was married to her and he divorced her by the time he became our history teacher. And when I went to work in Fleet Street, the story came up when she first got the gig of being, I think Anna Ford was the first woman newsreader and then she was going to be the second one. And somebody said, I wonder if she's married. I wonder if anybody knows anything about her private. I said, oh, I know, being a naive cat. I said, I know, because her first husband was my history teacher at school. So it's right, go and find him. And we went to find him and we had to confront him on his doorstep. And he was one of absolutely favourite teachers and he was absolutely horrified by it. And his snatched picture of him appeared on the front page of the newspaper.
Oh, bless him.
Yeah, it was awful. And he taught me a number of lessons, really. One is about, you know, you've got to be very careful about using your personal contacts in journalism without it going wrong. But the funny thing was that when I was doing history A-level, he always used to say to me, you should be a journalist, you know, because you're not really interested in the sort of big sort of, you're interested in all the trivia, like why Lord Northcliffe had syphilis and, you know, sort of all the details of people's private lives. And you should be a tabloid journalist. So after this incident happened, I said, you do remember telling me.
So it was basically his fault.
It was his fault, yeah. So he laughed about it afterwards. I said, you do remember that you told me to go into this line of work.
That's full circle.
This is what happened.
Oh. Well, that has given us a huge amount to think about after what seems like a fantastically inspiring hour with Fiona. I think my favourite part was where she jumped straight in to be a head. I just thought that was brilliant. And I think she'd be a very impressive head. I think she'd certainly hold everyone to account and drive up those standards very quickly.
See, I wouldn't want to get on the wrong side of Fiona. No, she was absolutely brilliant. I just loved the bit about seeing the world through the eyes of teenagers and how unimpressed her children were with the regular visits to Checkers. And the wonderful reminder of the fabulous Mo Mollem. And I wish I could have gone to a party with Mo Mollem. That would have been incredible. But absolutely loads and loads to think about there. Also made me interested in Camden, made me nostalgic about my time teaching in Camden. And it does feel as if Camden's managed to maintain some of that unique ethos of work hard, play hard, real social moral purpose. I don't know. I'm probably being a bit sentimental, but
no, I think it's important. And I think, you know, certainly what's come across for me, having never been to Camden before, is just seeing how well-regarded education is here. Even just the signs on the way down, as I said, celebrating all these fantastic schools. There's certainly a sense of, you know, you're doing really well by your children here in Camden, which is really exciting to see.
And I also have to say, it sounds a bit cheesy, but I genuinely admire Fiona for putting her money where her mouth is, Fiona and Alistair, and sending their children through the state system. And the bit that I found genuinely moving was about working with the primary school to actually make it better whilst keeping our children in there. It's that thing of you've got to be in it to fight it, haven't you? But it Definitely. Takes a lot to put yourself in that when you're working full-time and writing a book.
Yeah, I think it's easy to underestimate the impact and just the sheer responsibility that school governors have, and she's honoured that for a really long time and I'm sure done incredible work. For me, I think the standout was listening to how her family lived through that experience of the Iraq war, of that complete disagreement, and how the children had to pick up the fallout from that, and I can empathise with that to a certain degree, and I just found that fascinating to hear her reflections on what that was like.
Yeah.
Fiona gave us a lot to think about there in terms of Ofsted, grammar schools, independent schools, parent choice. I'm sure it'll got a lot of you talking. So pick up the conversation at hashtag Clemenem Podcast with me at C Stewart SHS.
And me at Those That Can. And we'd love to hear from you on any of those issues if you can contact us. We've been told off by our producer because we've not been diverse enough. We've not had a single man on our podcast so far. So we promise you we'll be addressing that one very soon. And we'll look forward to having you tune in again soon.
Bye.
The Clemenem Podcast with Clemmy Stewart and Emma Kell. Special guest Fiona Miller. Produced by Rav Vadgama. The Clemenem Podcast is a Those That Can production.